This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate, then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
NATO may be getting bigger. Finland's leaders want in, turning their backs on decades of neutrality.
This shift is big and remarkable.
And unwelcome in Moscow. Also ahead, the investigation into the assassination of Haiti's president remains stalled.
We're waiting to learn more about the motivation and exactly what went down on that evening.
But now, a former Haitian senator has been extradited to the U.S., possibly bringing fresh clues. And the Taliban wants Afghan women to wear the burqa, covering themselves from head to toe. Small groups of women are saying no. I'm Carol Hills. Plus, Brazilian voters hear a familiar voice on the presidential campaign trail.
Governar deve ser sobretudo.
Lula is back and promising to bring back better times. That's all ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. NATO may soon be getting bigger. Today, Finland's leaders called on their nation to apply for membership into the Western Military Alliance. The move challenges a Finnish belief held for decades that peace was best maintained through neutrality. The war in Ukraine has shattered that. As for how Russia is taking Finland's announcement, Russia's foreign ministry is threatening retaliatory steps. Joining me now to talk about this is Anna Wieslander. She's the director for Northern Europe at the Atlantic Council and is in Stockholm. Just how significant is it that Finland is abandoning its neutral position?
Well, it's remarkable. It's historical. It has not been neutral in the strict way it was during the Cold War since it joined the EU in the European Union in 1995, because the European Union has a solidarity clause as well, and is a sort of a political alliance with also some defense ambitions. But it has definitely been military non-aligned and not relying on any security guarantees from any other state up until now. So this shift is big in that sense and remarkable.
There is now broad public support in Finland for joining NATO. How has public opinion on this question changed so quickly?
Well, that's an interesting question, because it was very clear that the Russian full-scale invasion against Ukraine, that really made the pulse skyrocket when it came to the Finns wanting to join NATO. I think they had not expected any such cruel and aggressive actions from Russia, not a full-scale invasion and this total destruction that we are seeing, and a will to erase Ukraine's sovereignty completely. That really scared a lot of Finns and made them shift towards joining the alliance. And it's a small country close to a very dominating, powerful neighbor, and a feeling of drawing parallels also. Ukraine being outside of NATO, and we are outside of NATO, and this could happen to us as well.
Now, Russia has vowed to, quote, take retaliatory steps, both of a military, technical, and other nature. What could that mean?
Well, what we believe this would mean is that Russia would probably move military installations closer to its western borders. And then short-term hand, it could be cyber attacks or disinformation campaigns. It could be electronic jamming, and also what we have already seen, intrusions of jet fighters into airspace of Finland and Sweden. But we do not foresee that Russia would take any more military measures of trying to attack in that sense.
You're speaking to us from Sweden, which is also known for its long-standing neutrality, and Sweden's expected to announce its decision on applying for NATO soon. What impact would that have on Russia?
Well, I think that it goes very much together because both Sweden and Finland are EU member states. So in that sense, we are, you know, we abandon neutrality. We will be solidaric towards other EU member states. We have committed to that through the Lisbon Treaty, but we have not joined NATO, although we have cooperated very closely with NATO, and Russia knows that, in the Baltic Sea region since the worsened security situation in 2014 caused by Russia versus Ukraine already then. So I think it goes very much hand in hand, Sweden and Finland joining NATO and the way Russia looks at this, because it's we are neighbors, we are cooperating already intensely on defense. We are cooperating closely with NATO and our neighbors here in the area. So Russia knows all of this, of course, and will take it takes a strategic look on the Baltic Sea region and the Arctic, in which Sweden and Finland are not twins, but perhaps siblings, you can say.
Finally, now that Finland says it wants to join NATO, what's the process from here?
Well, this is just a matter of days, as we see it. It will be a political announcement from the Social Democrats this weekend, and then parliamentary discussion, debate, and decision early next week. And from then, we can expect Finland to send in an application or notify NATO that they want an invitation to join the alliance. Just weeks before the invitation comes, you know, it could be a couple of weeks, and then you have the Madrid summit. Already then, we could be Finland could be treated as an invited member and sit at the table. But you will have a ratification process, which has to be done in all parliaments of members in the alliance, 30 countries, and that could take several months after that.
Anna Wieslander is Director for Northern Europe at the Atlantic Council and Secretary General of the Swedish Defense Association. She joined us from Stockholm. Anna, thank you for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you so much.
As much as we'd like to be done with it, COVID remains a threat. The U.S. just officially surpassed a grim milestone, 1 million reported COVID deaths. Across the globe, cases are rising in more than 70 countries, and new variants could still emerge. Today, the White House co-led a high-profile gathering of global leaders to try and re-energize the pandemic response. The World's Alana Gordon reports on what's been an uphill effort.
The story of the summit really begins last fall when the White House convened the first global summit. Here's Vice President Kamala Harris speaking then.
I believe we will all be able to look back to this very moment, at the start of this new era, as the moment when our world joined together.
It was a call for the world to come together to vaccinate the world, to expand testing and the availability of new life-saving treatments. Leaders mapped out big goals. Commitments came in, as did hundreds of millions of donated vaccines. But then, Andrea Taylor is a researcher at Duke's Global Health Institute.
At the beginning, there was all this talk about, you know, we're all in this together and no one's safe till everyone's safe. But then it turned out when the high-income countries decided they were safe, they were like, just kidding. We're good. We're good. Thanks. We're moving on.
She says global efforts stalled. Many communities are struggling to get basic supplies to support health workers and vaccine campaigns, even when vaccines have finally arrived. It's been painful for Dr. Bonaventure Ayisibwe.
We had expected that by the time we have the second summit, we're seeing some very clear action.
Ayisibwe has helped lead the pandemic response in Uganda and is with the NGO Seed Global Health. He says too many Ugandans have suffered from long periods of lockdowns. Too many who are older and more at risk remain unvaccinated and without care.
I worry that in the next phase of COVID, we'll continue to see clusters of COVID deaths in very vulnerable communities where their death won't matter to anyone. And it will happen at a time when the concerted global investment has moved on and it is difficult to mobilize the resources and the attention needed to protect those communities.
This was the uncomfortable backdrop at today's second global COVID summit, Wariness and Hope.
Today, we're at a new stage in fighting this pandemic, facing an evolving set of challenges. We have to double down on our efforts to get shots in people's arms, country by country, community by community.
President Biden kicked off the event. He stressed the need for faster testing and treating and committed support for health workers.
And we have to prevent complacency. This summit is an opportunity to renew our efforts to keep her foot on the gas when it comes to getting this pandemic under control and preventing future health crises.
Unlike the first summit, this one was more inclusive. Indonesia was a co-host.
We must work together to mitigate the pandemic and build a stronger global health architecture and preparedness.
President Joko Widodo.
All peoples, without exception, must have access to essential health services. Health infrastructure must be adequate and equipped for pandemics.
Senegal and Germany were also co-hosts. And Belize, whose president, Johnny Briceño, highlighted that cases are up in the Caribbean.
Now is the time to double on what we know works. Testing, vaccination, treatments, and appropriate public health measures.
The summit brought more pledges, like for a new preparedness fund through the World Bank. The African Union committed to improve health systems and vaccinations. A new initiative will work with countries to make antivirals cheaper and more widely available. But major challenges still loom large. South Africa's president raised concerns about the lack of support for local manufacturing of vaccines and treatments. In the U.S., Congress has yet to fund the White House's request for $5 billion for the global pandemic response. Javier Guzman is with the U.S. think tank, the Center for Global Development. He's also a former health leader in Colombia.
It went as expected. Some very positive news and some more of the same.
He says the summit created needed momentum. But the real test is whether this translates to action and coordination, or just more talk. For The World, I'm Alana Gordon.
Google Translate is one handy tool.
Google Translate est un outil pratique.
It lets you write something in a language that you know, then convert that into a language you don't know.
Don't know.
Such as Russian.
Не знаю.
Or Mandarin.
不知道.
Or Arabic.
Не знаю.
Yesterday, the CEO of Alphabet, Google's parent company, unveiled something new.
Today, I'm excited to announce that we are adding 24 new languages to Google Translate.
Sundar Pichai told a developers conference that Google Translate can now read indigenous languages such as Quechua. It's spoken by millions of people in Peru and Ecuador. Many folks in California also speak it. And now people worldwide will be able to auto-translate a text or an email into Quechua. The same applies for other previously unsupported languages such as Mizo.
India, COVID-19, we in Kolai, and Italian and Tlatiamzil.
Mizo is spoken by hundreds of thousands of people in northeastern India, Bangladesh, and Myanmar.
Amaule, amaule, amaule.
And there's Lingala, spoken and sung by tens of millions of people across Central Africa.
Amaule, 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 amaule.
Google Translate could already understand over 100 languages, from Afrikaans to Zulu. The company says it's learned these new languages with a boost from artificial intelligence, building on what Google's AI has already learned about how different languages work. For this story, we pulled recordings of indigenous languages from the website Omniglot. In Google Translate, you aren't yet able to hear Lingasa, or Mizo, or Quechua. It's just text for now. Voice recognition for Google's new languages is still a work in progress. But here's what Quechua sounds like in real life. That's Quechua author and activist Irma Alvarez Cosco. She's describing the first time she saw her people's language printed in a book. The new upgrade of Google Translate might provide a similar thrill for hundreds of millions of people throughout the Americas, Africa, and India. For many, it will be the first time that their own words can be read and understood by people just about everywhere. Coming up, a young political candidate in Lebanon is banking on a more hopeful future for his country. Our conversation is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. In Lebanon, it's been one crisis after another for the past few years. A deadly port explosion, spiraling debt, food insecurity, and a lack of political leadership, to name just a few problems. But now Lebanon has a chance to flip the script. The nation holds parliamentary elections on Sunday. One candidate who believes that things can change is Musba Sakit. He's running for a seat representing the northern Lebanese city of Tripoli, which is where he's speaking to us from. Musba, What's the platform that you're running on? What do you want to deliver to voters in Tripoli?
We want to deliver to the voters in Tripoli that they have to act. They have to act for change. They have to help us and to help themselves to change the world situation in Lebanon.
When you say you want the voters to take action, does that mean you want them to vote for you, a candidate who wants change? Or do you want them to do other things as well?
The best way and the only way that we have to change is to vote for independent people that are running all over Lebanon and in Tripoli especially. We need the voters vote for us for change, to change the situation and to trying to stop the corruption.
If you're elected, what can you do to fight against corruption?
We have many things to do to stop corruptions. First of all, we have to question the government about the money of the people that can't have them from the banks. We have to put some new rules that fight the corruption in the government and the institutions.
Can you tell us about the economic situation in your city, Tripoli, right now?
Tripoli is the poorest city in Lebanon. The economic situation in Tripoli is very horrible. I don't exaggerate when I say that we have many people that stay 2 or 3 days without food. They don't have money to bring food. And the poverty rate in Tripoli, based on the rates that are delivered by the government, is now over than 65%, which is very sad.
Lebanese people have been really disgusted with their elected leaders. The international community doesn't trust the Lebanese government either. What motivates you to run for office?
As we said before, to change and to bring a better future for the Lebanese, especially for the youth, because the future is ours. And if we didn't act right now to change the world situation in Lebanon, our future will be dark. Second, because we need to prevent the militia of Hezbollah from getting more seats in the Lebanese parliament. If we didn't run for the office or for the election, definitely Hezbollah will have more seats, which will be terrible for the Lebanon.
Tripoli, your city, is the longtime political home of the powerful Hariri family, and there isn't a member of the Hariri family running in this election. How does that change the race, in your opinion?
To be realistic, this will affect the election. We are afraid that this absence of the Hariri family and the future movement will lower the rate of election this Sunday. We hope that this will not last and they will go to vote for change and against Hezbollah.
How would you go about helping the people in Tripoli? What needs to happen to solve, say, the food shortages and the economic crisis?
The World Bank had gave Lebanese government a program for food security, but this program is stopped in the government because the politicians and the ministers, that they are corrupted. So we hope that after election, if we will be elected, we have to work to have this program back.
Masba Sakit is a parliamentary candidate in his hometown of Tripoli, Lebanon. Lebanon's elections are on Sunday. Masba, thank you very much.
Thank you again.
In Iraq, thousands of Yazidis are fleeing their historic homeland, an area near the border with Syria and Turkey. The Yazidis are an ethno-religious minority in Iraq, now caught between two battling neighbors. Reporter Yasmin Mossiman has more from the Sharia camp in northern Iraq.
Iman Jalal stands patiently in the camp administration office, waiting on her cardboard box of food aid. She's only 18, but she's already fled home 3 times. She was 10 when ISIS's murderous rampage in Sinjar sent her family bolting out of their house to this camp. And she was 13 when the plastic tent they were given was eaten away by an electrical fire, a common occurrence at the camp. The family was scared of dying in the next fire, so they decided to go back to Sinjar. But as of last week, they've returned to Sharia camp. The army and the PKK started shooting at each other. We were frightened. The bullets hit our house, he says. On May 1st, fighting broke out between the Iraqi military and the YBS, a militia comprised mostly of local Yazidis, with strong ties to Kurdish PKK insurgents from Turkey. Back at their new tent, the family shows me pictures on their phone of bullet holes in their house caused by the latest bout of fighting. They say they huddled together in one room until the fighting stopped long enough for them to brave an escape. All my siblings were scared, so we were forced to leave and return to Kurdistan, says Jalal. And she's not alone. 10,000 civilians have fled on the same routes they took almost 8 years ago. That's when ISIS killed and captured around 10,000 Yazidis in what the United Nations has described as genocide. Men were slaughtered en masse. Women were subjected to sexual slavery. For some, last week's events triggered memories of the genocide. Even for those too young to remember it, the communal trauma endures. Faiz Haji also recently fled Sinjar. Whenever the children hear any shooting, they run to their moms. And they say, ISIS has come for us, he says. Haji thinks the only solution is for all armed groups to withdraw from civilian areas in Sinjar and leave security to local police. Protesters have been gathering daily in Sinjar, calling for the same thing.
We came to the street to demonstrate against all of them. We say we don't want anyone except local police and like intelligence of Iraq.
That's Dr. Hussein Rasho, a physician and activist from Sinjar. He's been one of the main protest organizers. He says the sheer scale of violence at the center of a civilian area prompted them into action.
We didn't see such thing like that since 3rd of August 2014. I mean, the Yazidi genocide that happened when ISIS invaded.
The grassroots protests started small, with only a few people. But in the last few days, over 1,000 people have shown up. That's a lot for a small area. Rasho says Sinjaris feel stuck in a tug of war between different security actors and don't know who to trust.
Like if you came to Sinjar, you will see like many checkpoints and mixed from the different military groups.
Sinjar is disputed between the federal Iraqi government and the Kurdistan region. A security agreement signed a year and a half ago between the two governments has failed to simplify the maze of armed actors operating in the area. Besides the Iraqi army and Kurdish rebels who Turkey regularly launches airstrikes against, there's also Iran-backed militias. Locals say all these actors don't have the best interests of Yazidis in mind and have hindered efforts to rebuild the still dilapidated town. Fighting has stopped for now, but those who fled think the quiet is suspicious. Iman Jalal says she won't return until the people of Sinjar hold their fates in their own hands. Until then, she'll have to sleep alongside her siblings, with one eye open in this 4x4-meter plastic tent, always worried about the next fire. For the world, I'm Yasmin Mossiman, Sharia, Iraq.
There's a lot more coming up. You're listening to The World. When the war began, Ukraine's president called on foreign fighters and medics to come join the fight. We hear from one woman from Utah who heeded the call to join the International Legion of Ukraine.
It's raining. It looked like something out of a movie. There's a small pinup tent that you take to a soccer game that said Legion spray painted on the side. And I was like, that must be it.
That's coming up on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH and PRX. In Afghanistan, the Taliban government is implementing new rules for women. Bodies must be fully covered, as well as most of their faces, whenever they're in public. The Taliban also say that women should not go out in public unless absolutely necessary. As The World's Shirin Jafari reports, many Afghan women are angry with the new rules.
August 15th of last year is seared into the mind of Aghala Amiri. She's an 18-year-old in Kabul. And that's the day when the Taliban took over her city. She remembers chaos and panic. Everything happened so fast. Amiri was wearing her usual outfit, a yellow jacket and a scarf that covered her hair. As the news spread, it was like a switch had been flipped, she says. Even the taxi drivers stopped giving her rides, worried they might get into trouble with the Taliban for providing services to an unaccompanied woman. For younger Afghans like Amiri, the Taliban rule of the 1990s was something from the distant past. Now, about 9 months later, they are experiencing it firsthand. And Amiri says it's a nightmare.
مثل همیشه رفته بودم بیرون این شلاقی که دستشون بود زد روی دست من چند بار.
A few days after the fall of Kabul, Amiri was randomly stopped by a Taliban fighter. He complained that her sleeves were too short. Her hair was showing, not acceptable for a Muslim woman. Before she could say anything, the man whipped her on the arms. She showed me pictures of the bruises, which she took later when she got home. Amiri says she felt humiliated, scared, and angry.
تمام بدبختی‌هایی که در این کشور هست در واقع از همین افراط بلند میشه.
This type of fanatical thinking, she says, is the root cause of all our misery in this country. Since that incident, Amiri has stopped wearing colorful outfits in public. Now she wears a long black loose cloak. She makes sure her hair is not showing. But now the Taliban are imposing even stricter rules. Over the weekend, Taliban officials issued a decree listing several new restrictions. Among them, women must wear the burqa, the head-to-toe covering that has mesh across the eyes. The decree also requires that women only leave home when absolutely necessary. If they don't follow these rules, their male relatives will be punished. In response, small groups of women in Kabul and other cities are going out to protest. Julia Parsi was among the protesters this week. She is a women's rights activist. We marched in the streets, she tells me, from Kabul, but the Taliban stopped us and told us to go home. Parsi and others tried to reason with the men. They said they are upset about the new restrictions and that women in Afghanistan are observant Muslims. They already dress modestly in public. I will never agree to cover my face, Parsi says. I won't be able to breathe. Women protesters in Afghanistan have paid a heavy price since the Taliban takeover. One woman I spoke to said she was arrested and detained for several weeks for protesting. Her family was threatened, so she put a pause on her activism. And the dress code is just one of many restrictions the Taliban have imposed on women. They've also limited their access to education and employment. Julia Parsi, who has two daughters, says her heart breaks when she sees them at home instead of school. They have no future in this country, she says. That's why I risk my life to protest. I'm scared, but what other choice do I have? For Zahra Rahimi, watching all this from outside Afghanistan is painful. She was a reporter for a TV program. When the Taliban came to power, they threatened her and her family. She fled and now lives in Canada. Rahimi says some Taliban leaders claim that women's rights is a Western concept and that only the elite in Kabul care about issues like women's education and jobs.
We had a father from Paktia, from the farthest منطقه افغانستان که او
My own father comes from a remote area in Afghanistan, she says. He used to take me and my sister to school every day on a motorcycle. The trip was 2 hours long. He wanted us, his daughters, to be educated, she says. Rahimi's family is still in Afghanistan. She's most worried about her 15-year-old sister.
من هر شب که صحبت میکنم میگم وقتی که میخوای بری بیرون خواهش میکنم به خاطر طالبان به خاطر حفظ جان خودت.
Every night when I talk to her, I tell her to be careful, Rahimi tells me. I tell her to wear whatever the Taliban have ordered. Don't risk your life. My sister is upset about this, Rahimi says, but there's nothing I can do. Critics of the Taliban restrictions on women say the group has one goal, to make women disappear from public life. The Taliban might have the guns and be in charge politically, but many Afghan women still say they won't stop fighting for their basic rights. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
It's been more than 10 months since Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated in his home. Dozens of people have been arrested since then. The latest is a former Haitian senator extradited from Jamaica to the U.S. last week. Still, so far, investigations have not cracked the case, and violence and gang kidnappings continue to plague Haiti in the absence of strong leadership there. Jacqueline Charles has been reporting on Haiti for the Miami Herald for many years and joins us now. Jacqueline, first, briefly remind us what happened to Moïse and how he was killed.
So on July 7th, in the middle of the night, Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was assassinated. According to police, he was shot 12 times inside his bedroom of his private residence in the hills above Port-au-Prince. The alleged assailants, they came to the residence accompanied by Haitian national police officers and his own security forces, some of whom are accused of participating in his killing. Others just basically took off when this convoy of cars arrived at the top of the hill to the president's residence.
Now, the U.S. has arrested and charged three people so far. Tell us about that and where this case stands.
Yeah, so the United States is running a parallel investigation to Haiti's investigation, which is essentially stalled. The U.S., they currently have three individuals in custody, a former Colombian soldier, a former Haitian senator, and a Haitian businessman who was convicted of cocaine trafficking. What we are waiting to see is where these cases are going to go. In the case of the Colombian soldier, he has pled not guilty. So we expect for that to go to trial unless he changes his mind and decides to cooperate. So far, we know that the convicted cocaine trafficker is cooperating with U.S. authorities, and we're still waiting to hear what the senator is going to do.
Now, as I understand it, the U.S. is keeping some of this investigation secret because of protecting DEA informants. What's the story there?
So one of the things that was revealed during this whole episode is that a number of these individuals who have been jailed, they were either former DEA agents or, in the case of one individual who currently is not in custody, a former FBI informant. And so what we saw in recent weeks is that the United States asked a judge to seal some information to keep it secret. We've spoken to sources who believe that the U.S. just doesn't want to get embarrassed by the fact that maybe some of their former assets went rogue.
Who else has been charged in this case and why?
The only people who have been charged are the three individuals who are currently in custody in the United States. The nearly 40 individuals in Haiti, they have not been charged. It's been over 10 months. Haiti has had four different investigative judges on this case, but no formal charges have been brought against anyone currently in custody in Haiti.
There are 18 Colombians who are alleged to be linked to this. What is the story behind that?
According to the U.S. federal criminal indictment, this plot involved about 20 Colombian former soldiers. Currently, there are 18 in custody in Haiti. Three others were killed, and we know one is currently in the United States. They've said that they were hired to provide security for this Haitian-American pastor and doctor who is currently jailed in Haiti, and that they've had nothing to do with the killing of the president. Of course, Haitian police have not identified who actually pulled the trigger, but the Colombians are accused of being part of this assassination plot and of being used in this plot to kill Jovenel Moïse.
You've been reporting in Haiti for many years. What's it like there now since the assassination?
Things in Haiti are very chaotic. The level of violence, you know, on the 22nd of April, there was a police officer that was killed. 2 days later, what we saw was an armed gang conflict. According to one human rights group on the ground, at least 148 individuals were killed. We are hearing stories of just barbaric acts in terms of people just being cut up, their bodies thrown into wells. We're hearing, you know, allegations of gang rape, and some of the victims were children. The country right now is politically unstable. There's a humanitarian crisis pushing people to get into boats. Right now, we are experiencing the largest exodus of Haitians at sea in almost 20 years.
U.S. authorities did this week indict a major Haitian gang leader in the kidnappings of 16 Americans. Was that considered a positive step?
That is being considered a positive step because this is a very powerful gang leader. He was jailed in Haiti and he was still running this gang from behind bars. What we're hearing on the ground is people want to see more of that. I mean, the feeling today is that, you know, gangs and any other criminal elements can do what they want and there are no consequences to their actions. I mean, the court system in Haiti, the judicial system, has basically been non-functional for over a year. I mean, judges and lawyers can't even get to the courthouse because it's just a few yards away from a kidnapping lair that's controlled by a very powerful gang.
Jacqueline Charles is a reporter for the Miami Herald. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Brazilians will elect a new president in October. They'll see a very familiar name on the ballot. Last weekend, former President Luis Inácio Lula da Silva launched his pre-candidacy and a campaign that's expected to roll across the country over the next 5 months. But will voters give Lula another chance? Michael Fox has the story.
Spontaneous chants rang through the packed hall in Sao Paulo.
Lula!
The vibe in the room was electric.
Muitas famílias estão chorando. Muitos estão com fome.
Times are hard, Marinela Santana, a member of a black women's organization in Sao Paulo, told a camera live streaming the event. Many families are hungry. Many are hopeful of today. Lula, we need you, she said. After 2 hours of speeches, Lula finally took the stage.
Governar deve ser, sobretudo, ato de amor.
He promised to bring back better times. Besides the pandemic, he said, Brazil has been experiencing rising poverty, hunger, and increasing authoritarianism under President Jair Bolsonaro.
Queremos votar para que ninguém nunca mais ouse desafiar a democracia.
Lula said, we want to return so that no one ever dares to challenge democracy again, and for fascism to go back to the sewers of history where it should never have left. That's the theme of Lula's campaign, democracy and unity against the far-right incumbent. Lula has even joined forces with his former right-wing political rival Geraldo Alckmin. He'll be his running mate with the hopes of winning over more centrist Brazilians. Alckmin is the ex-governor of Sao Paulo who lost to Lula in the 2006 presidential election. Alckmin spoke to the crowd via teleconference from his home after testing positive for COVID-19.
Nenhuma divergência do passado.
No differences, past or present, he said, would be a reason to stop me from defending with all of my conviction Lula's return to the presidency. He is not the only one.
O movimento para reconstruir...
The event was also the launch of a coalition of 14 labor unions and left parties and dozens of social movements which are organizing for Lula's return. Lula is the most iconic figure of the Brazilian left. He served 2 terms as president in the 2000s. He launched social programs and lifted millions out of poverty. But at this time, 4 years ago, in the run-up to Brazil's last presidential election, Lula was in jail on a corruption charge that would block him from the race despite leading the polls. Today, he's free to run. The Supreme Court threw out the charges against him last year when it decided that the judge who convicted him was biased and should not have ruled over the case. Lula again leads all of the polls, but October 2nd is still a long way off, says political scientist Luciana Santana. Today, Lula is a viable candidate and he has a chance of winning the election, she says. On the other hand, Bolsonaro also has a chance of winning, even if he's behind in the polls. That's because he controls the federal government with huge resources. Over the last 30 years in Brazil, no sitting president has lost his or her bid for re-election. President Bolsonaro also has unbending support from his loyal followers, who make up roughly a quarter of the population. Bolsonaro held one of his iconic motorcycle rallies in the southern state of Paraná this week. Crowds lined the street waving Brazilian flags. Luciano da Haas is a political scientist at the Federal University of Santa Catarina. He says there are 650,000 dead from COVID-19, an army of unemployed, income has dropped, inflation has returned to 2 digits like we hadn't seen in 25 years. And even with all of that, Bolsonaro supporters believe in him, and they will continue to vote for him. Bolsonaro actually rose in the polls recently when a prominent right-wing third-party candidate dropped out of the race. Due to the country's polarization between Lula and Bolsonaro, third-party candidates will likely play a much smaller role in this year's elections than in the past. The same can be said about the issue of corruption. This was a major concern for Brazilians 4 years ago. The Workers' Party lost numerous local races due to its ties to the car wash corruption scheme. But now, Bolsonaro and some of his family and associates are also wrapped up in their own scandals. Political scientist Luciana Santana says, your average voter in Brazil isn't worried about corruption. He's worried about surviving. He's worried about having public policies that serve him directly. One issue hangs ominously over the elections, concerns that President Bolsonaro may refuse to respect the results regardless of the outcome. Bolsonaro has long attacked Brazil's Supreme Court and criticized the country's electoral system. Last week, he said his political party would contract a private company to audit the elections, which he said might just be impossible. Bolsonaro has said he's not looking to stage a coup, But many fear he might be trying to build the narrative for a January 6th-like scenario in case he loses the election. It's going to be a chaotic 5 months. The official electoral campaigns start in mid-August. For The World, I'm Michael Fox.
If you're a history nerd or film buff, you probably appreciate historical accuracy in movies, right? The World's Joshua Coe recently dug into a new Viking-themed movie and how the producers made sure they got it right, from costumes to set design. Check out that story and others you might have missed on The World by heading over to our website. We're at theworld.org. Early in Ukraine's war, that nation's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, made a plea for foreign volunteers. He asked them to come to his country to fight and defend, as he put it, Europe and the world. A few weeks later, he announced some 16,000 volunteers had heeded the call. The foreign fighters and medics are spread throughout the country. This week, Ukrainian journalist Volodymyr Solohub sat down with members of one brigade called the International Legion of Ukraine. They were east of Kharkiv, just 2 or 3 miles from the war's front lines. Volodymyr joins us now from Dnipro in eastern Ukraine. Volodymyr, set the scene for us. Where did you meet this group?
Getting access to military or the frontline positions is very difficult. And getting access to military on the frontline positions is close to impossible. It took us 2 days to try and arrange this meeting, and we knew one of the platoon commanders there and arranged the meeting with him. And it was only when we met him in person we found out that he's a member of Ukraine International Legion, even though he's a Ukrainian soldier.
Hmm. Volodymyr, what other countries are represented in the Foreign Legion Corps you visited?
There are people from all over the world. While we were there, we were talking to 2 different Americans, several Germans. There was someone from Ireland and someone from Croatia and Georgia. So it's like a international military United Nations here in Ukraine.
Now, I know not everyone in the group is fighting. Some are providing medical care. Isn't that right?
Yes. Glenna, someone we met when we got to these frontline positions and we started talking to the guys, she said that she's a combat medic, but she is one of the few of the medics in the unit, which has almost 75 people. They said that they are in drastic need of more medics in their unit.
We're going to hear a bit of your interview with Glenna. She asked for security reasons that we not use her last name. What struck you about her?
Actually, she was a very forthcoming person. And when we were there, she was actually the only female member of the unit among those that we've seen when we were in these positions.
That's interesting. Glenna, I know, is there helping provide medical care in the field, but she has seen some combat, hasn't she?
Yeah, actually 3 days before we arrived, they told us that they were hit quite heavily by Russian artillery and cluster bombs. They said that it lasted for several hours, and they lost one of their men in that incident. And Glenna told me when she got to the body of that person that was killed, she thought it was her platoon commander, and she froze for a second.
And Glenna has not had a lot of formal medical training, has she?
No, not at all. Before coming to Ukraine, she briefly used to work in an ambulance, and before that, she was a Navy service person. She told me that she had some combat training once she got to Ukraine and volunteered.
What motivated Glenna to travel across the world and put herself in harm's way?
She saw on the news what is happening in Ukraine, and she told me that she thought that this was absolutely wrong when a big, powerful country unprovokedly invades another country, being Ukraine.
I feel like it's a human thing. It's just not right to sit on the couch and knowing you can make a difference and sit there and watch and send pennies and, I don't know, add an extra dollar to my McDonald's drive-thru thing. And I could actually be here doing hands-on. My mom asked me the same thing. I told her there's 100 pennies in a dollar. I know I'm not, you know, Johnny Rambo going to win the war, but, you know, it's a bunch of gears and a clock, so.
So when did you get here and how did you actually get to Ukraine?
I got here on April 1st, so April Fool's. I left Utah on the 31st of March. So I got on a plane, Seattle, Germany, and then to Poland. I was like, well, I might die here doing this, so I'm going to get a 5-star hotel. Wasted all my money on a 5-star hotel. So I hit the train station, took me a whole day. Then the train, they went transfer over my ticket, so I ended up walking 6 miles in a snowstorm. with all my gear, it was awful. And then I finally got to the border, and when I crossed, the Ukrainian guys, the border patrol, they gave me more crap than the Polish people did or anybody else did. Like, why are you here? I was like, I'm here to join the Legion. How long are you gonna stay?
until you don't need me. I don't know. And then, yeah, I crossed, and it was a long walk at the border crossing. And then it's raining. It looked like something out of a movie. There's a small pinup tent that you take to a soccer game that said Legion spray painted on the side. And I was like, that must be it. And here I am.
How has it been for you down here on the front line?
The whole air raid things and the missiles and the strikes, it's very hard to sleep comfortably or get sleep at all. I don't know how these people have been doing it for 2-3 months now since this thing started. Like, I'm definitely shell-shocked. But it's something deep down that just, like, when I lay my head and sleep at bed at night, it's not safe. And that's the only way I can put it.
You are part of the International Legion fighting here. Can you tell me a little bit more about the people who surround you?
Yeah. I was Utah, very sheltered, haven't really been very many places, and so I haven't really met a Croatian or someone from Ireland or someone like that. And I got here, and it was just such a culture shock. I learned so many things every day. We cook meals together like a family, at least the group that I'm with. We always sit down together and eat. We all take turns cooking and cleaning, and we tell each other stories from our home, and it's crazy. It's like nothing I've ever seen before.
Does it feel weird to be thousands of miles away from your home, surrounded by people from all over the world, cooking, as you said, together, yeah, getting meal together, but then at the same time risking your lives and being at risk of being killed every moment?
Yeah, it's like a 2-mile walk for me to come and get Wi-Fi, and you know, I'll download like a movie or something, and then I'll go back. For some reason, I don't know why, I keep looking at my photos, and I'll scroll back from photos from home. As for my platoon, it's like, I hope to God, like, when we had those airstrikes that we lost somebody. I got there, and he kind of looked like my platoon leader, and I froze for a second. I was like, this is someone I've ate with and drank with, but I'm trying my best. And those other guys, after the shelling that happened, ended up leaving, put things into perspective for them. I don't blame them at all. I mean, they had kids and wives and stuff. Like, I don't have anything like that. And so I've never actually been mortared before. I mean, that shell landed, like, I would say like 30, 40 yards behind me. And I remember falling down the hill. But I pray to God that I never actually have to treat one of these guys, because I don't know how I would be able to do it. They're like family now. Like, we've all made plans to, I don't know, come back here when it's good and clear, or go to some hotel and party, or go visit each other and stuff like that. But yeah, I don't know how I'm actually going to be able to, I don't know, treat one of these guys when I see him lying there. But yeah, I'd gladly fight by him and just die by him. They're just family.
That's an American volunteer named Glenna on the front lines in eastern Ukraine. She spoke with our colleague, Ukrainian journalist Volodymyr Solohub. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. See you back here tomorrow.